This is Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, our performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. World-class opportunities abound this month as Iowa is blessed with an amazing array of art exhibits, concerts, and movie stars. We'll gain a unique perspective as the director of the Des Moines Art Center, Jeff Fleming, shares insights about their Gravity and Grace, monumental works by L. Anatsui. The exhibition opens on October 24th. Members of the Iowa Composers Forum gear up for their fall Opus Concert Cafe event in Cedar Rapids tonight, featuring 9 newly composed works. We'll get the inside scoop as Hollywood meets River City, when the Iowa Independent Film Festival's co-founder, Tana Frederick, heads back to Mason City for their annual festival scheduled to be held later this month. And we'll delve into Operett Simpson's double bill presentation of Puccini's War Angelica and Britten's Curlew River, opening the weekend of October 11th at Simpson College in Indianola. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
I think this show in particular, it holds those things that mean, well, hopefully certainly to this community and the institution, but I must say to me personally, where you look at cultural objects and those objects can carry with it a multi-layered history, but at the same time it's so aesthetically pleasing and it's so beautiful that you can respond to it on so many levels. This is that show. And so for me, this is it. So I'm very excited about the possibility. And a critic said something really quite wonderful about African art. And this is important to know, this is more than African art, but that Africans do not make art for art's sake, that Africans make art for life's sake.
Jeff Fleming, director of the Des Moines Art Center, describing their incredible exhibition called Gravity and Grace, monumental works by L. Anatsui. Anticipation is mounting as they prepare to install the work of this world-renowned artist. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
This is something I am just absolutely excited about. The artist is L. Anatsui. He was born in Ghana. He lives now in Nigeria. And then the exhibition is called Gravity and Grace, Monumental Works by L. Anatsui. And it indeed is monumental. The exhibition was organized by the Akron Museum of Art. Although he's 65 years old, he's certainly been working for many years, but he really came to international attention in probably 2007. When the Venice Biennale, which is the large international exhibition, presented his work both in the Arsenale, which is a large exhibition space, as well as a work hanging by the Grand Canal. And so when you say monumental, these works are, they could be, you know, 20 by 30 feet and in size. But it is all the more remarkable when you see what they're made of. So although it is this huge, it's not exactly a sculpture, it's certainly not a painting, you can call them wall hangings or hangings for lack of a better term, but many of them are made up of tiny bits of refuge. They could be discarded milk tops. It could be discarded liquor bottles. For example, you would unscrew a liquor bottle and then throw away the top, and that metal piece, you would perhaps unroll it, and you would have something perhaps the size of a stick of chewing gum. And this would be the building blocks for these monumental pieces. And the studio process is much like a quilt. You would create a block of these pieces sewn together, and then you would combine the blocks until you have a very massive piece. And he calls them, in essence, walls, and he's really quite poetic and metaphorical. And he says that, you know, walls really reveal more than they hide. And I think that's very telling when you talk about El Anatsui's work, because he does come from a culture that is a mixture of a variety of cultures. His African culture certainly has had relationships to the Americas. It certainly has relationship to Europe, and of course its own indigenous culture, African cultures. And the notion of liquor is just one of those things. It really doesn't matter that these come from liquor, but it adds this level of meaning and cultural exchange, and even a commercial exchange that you can bring into something that's already beautiful, extraordinarily beautiful, but then it's very potent at the same time. For example, rum, in large part, and don't hold me to this, but certainly it was used in the slave trade. And it was one of the mechanisms which propelled rum into the economic forefront, not only in Europe, but also in the Americas. But it was used to buy slaves in part in this part of the country. And so that very potent history alone adds something to this work that is beyond just its reuse of materials. It is about people handling something, touching something. The objects themselves carry a history of human interaction, and that is extremely meaningful.
The exhibition called Gravity and Grace, Monumental Works by El Anatsui, includes 29 pieces and will occupy all three buildings of the Des Moines Arts Center. 12 of the works are enormous wall hangings. The display also includes earlier pieces, which some describe as wood wall reliefs. El Anatsui's art is known for the powerful way it bridges the physical and spiritual nature of life. In addition to the exhibition, Jeff is thrilled about the center's extra events accompanying the show.
There's a variety of programs that will accompany it. The artist is coming to Des Moines, as it is now scheduled, and he and I will have a conversation on Tuesday night, October 22nd. And he very rarely travels, although he does. And so we're very excited that he will be coming and that he will have a public presentation. And so it's certainly something not to be missed, as the exhibition is certainly not to be dismissed. We see it as one of the blockbusters of the year, and there's a great deal of interest in the show.
And one thing that he likes to do with this, that with each space that his works are exhibited, he leaves it up to you at the Art Center to display it the way you feel is correct for the space.
Absolutely, which is very unusual, particularly for a contemporary artist to do that. But the work is malleable. It is like fabric. We talked about it being quilt-like in terms of its creation, but it folds up and it comes in a box and then you unfold it. And to hang it, it is meant to have creases, it's meant to have folds, it's meant to have sections that are raised. And so it does give the installers and the institutions a great deal of freedom. And many critics have responded to this idea of freedom coming from the artist's own existence as the artist defined himself as a nomad. In other words, the notion that he was born in Ghana, but then left Ghana and came to Nigeria. And we've talked about a variety of influences, but he certainly does go and use symbols indigenous to Africa, such as kente cloth and a variety of other materials. But this notion of being a nomad and drawing from that experience as well as drawing from that visual experience, for example, he says in Nigeria, their cloth bags, where immigrants or others might carry their belongings, and they're actually called Ghana must-go bags. So this notion of travel, this notion of being a nomad, this notion of being displaced from your home or at least away from home, is a part of his personal experience. And then he, again, it's another metaphoric level of how others may participate in his work and allowing that freedom for others to be nomads along with the artist. It's a very extraordinary gesture, and one very, very excited as an institution to be able to participate in.
Now, you had mentioned that he himself was coming for this, and you have several other opportunities and things in conjunction with this exhibit. Tell us about those.
Oh, absolutely. From film series to gallery talks. And I'm very excited about the gallery talks. This is something we certainly do all the time. But for this show, since we do see it as so important and it's so much material that we can share and engage a public with, we're having three duet gallery talks, if you'd like to call them that. For example, I will do one with a textile professor at ISU. The chief curator would do one with an artist, I believe. The associate curator would do one. So it is not just coming from an art background, but we like to bring in other dialogues and other points of reference, be they social, educational, or artistic. And that I'm very excited about, simply because this show is so potent and it has so many avenues to bring in that discussion. It's going to be an extraordinary project.
Well, how do you go about displaying it and making sure you've got it the way you want it?
It literally takes many, many hands. Obviously, the work is fragile, and you can't use a forklift, and you can't use any other type of mechanism. You have to use your hands. And that means, since they are so large, you're going to have a great many hands involved with it. So it could take 10 people, perhaps at the least, simply to hold up and install one of these works. So it will be a long and engaging process. But again, that notion of freedom and that notion of being able to contribute to the final aesthetic of the presentation is something that we're all excited about participating in.
And a piece of art that, from any perspective, I mean, either you're up close, you see a certain thing, but then you stand back and there's a totally different image.
Well, the notion of them being walls, if you were hanging, but walls, I think, is, again, it has such a layered meaning for it. So they could have this notion, it's metal, you know, so as notions of permanence. But what I also enjoy, which is quite beautiful when you see them from afar, because you see it in its totality. But if you do look closely, you'll see the labor of the hand, which could look into craftsmanship, the notion of weaving, the notion of women's work. I'm not quite sure his studio has women in it, but that notion of the laborious work of the hand, which is related to crafts and is often related to traditional women's work, such as textile and weaving and sewing. So all of that notion of the labor that went into this, the excessive labor that went into this, and the hands that went into making this. And again, the notion not only that these objects were touched and had a history of human use, be they liquor bottles or milk bottles or whatever, but also the history of the hand that put it together, the history of the hand that then assimilated the panels of the quilt, for lack of a better term, into a cohesive whole, and then the hands that actually hung it and were part of the aesthetic process in hanging that and making those decisions of folds and balance. It's really a great many things that art can be, and it is on display. For example, it is open for interpretation and open for the eyes to see in this particular project. Again, one of the reasons why it is such an astonishing show.
Jeff Fleming, director of the Des Moines Arts Center, talking about their upcoming exhibition called Gravity and Grace, Monumental Works by L. Anatsui. The show, which opens on October 25th, continues through February 9th of next year. To learn more about this remarkable exhibition and other events and educational opportunities, please go to DesMoinesArtsCenter.org. Just ahead, we'll chat with two members of the Iowa Composers Forum about their Opus Concert Cafe event being held tonight in Cedar Rapids. We'll learn what movies made the cut in the Iowa Independent Film Festival being held later this month in Mason City. And we'll scope out Operette Simpson's doubleheader being presented the weekend of October 11th. You're listening to the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
It's a way of presenting to the world something that's already going on. It's a way of extending our voice, if you will, to a larger public, to representing a really high level of creative musical work that's going on in the state that might not otherwise receive that recognition. And let's face it, there's not a whole lot of value of writing to put works in a drawer or in a closet and keep them there. It's a way of gaining a broader public exposure. It's an educational organization in that regard.
It's great. I mean, there's so much to learn from people who have been doing this for a long time, especially about getting your works played and just having that community feeling as composers rather than a competitive, you know, at each other's throats trying to be the best musician. It's just really nice to have a community of composers that can support each other and help each other to promote their work.
UNI Composition and Theory Senior Jillian Whitaker and Co-College's Professor Emeritus and Iowa Composers Forum Board of Directors Chair Jerry Owen, praising the merits of the Iowa Composers Forum. This is the IWARD Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Jerry played piano as a student and started composing when he was around 12. He attended DePaul in Indiana, received his master's at the University of Evansville, and completed his PhD in composition studies at the University of Iowa. Shortly after graduation, Jerry joined the music faculty at Coe College. Jerry also initiated several composers in residence programs, including one with the Cedar Rapids Symphony, now known as Orchestra Iowa, and also with the Red Cedar Chamber. After Jillian graduates from UNI in 2014, she intends to go to grad school for film composition and eventually hopes to follow her dream in LA. Jillian talks about how she began.
Well, I started composing, I think maybe middle school or high school. I don't remember exactly when, but it wasn't really like a today I felt like sitting down and composing. It was more of a just feeling compelled to write music. It was never a conscious choice. So it's just something I've always done and something I've always been as a composer. So when I got to college, I found out about the Iowa Composers Forum, and it's just been a great opportunity to network with other composers, and they always have competitions and events going on where you can just get involved, get your works performed, and hear other works that are being written today, which is really nice. So it's been a really great place to meet other composers.
You started, I guess, writing when you were around 14. What inspired you then?
The first piece that I consciously remember being inspired to write was a choir piece that I wrote. It was recently after I heard Eric Whitaker's piece, A Boy and a Girl, which it wasn't so much that that particular piece was special to me or different or anything, but I just went to a piano and wrote a choir piece because I just needed to do it. But I know I wrote a piano piece before that I honestly don't remember where that came from. So I guess kind of started doing it.
I might comment that Jillian is sitting next to us here because she is a composer, but she is also a winner of the student composers competition that is run by the Iowa Composers Forum annually. We have several levels, the student age groups, and the result is that these pieces that are the winning pieces from each age category are presented in concert at concerts of the Iowa Composers Forum each year. And the concert this evening is beginning with Jillian's work, Almost Real, for string quartet, which was a winner in last year's competition.
Jillian explains how it feels to have her work be the first on tonight's Opus Concert Cafe event.
Well, it's a little nerve-wracking being the first, but I'm very excited to hear the piece played by such great performers. I was a violinist before I was a saxophonist, so violin and fiddle music especially is sort of what I grew up with. So this piece, Almost Real, is based on a reel that I wrote, which is a type of Irish dance, but I chose to put it in 7/8 instead of the traditional 4/4, so it's not quite a reel, which is where the title comes from. And it turned into a theme in variations. It's actually sort of reminiscent of another string quartet I had heard by Ben Johnson. So that's kind of where a lot of the ideas from the piece came from. But I'm just really excited to hear it played by these performers.
I'd like to point out that the performers who are playing on this particular piece are some of the finest that Orchestra Iowa and the state of Iowa have to offer. In particular, I want to point out that the first violinist in this quartet is Luke Whitaker, who is the newly appointed concertmaster of Orchestra Iowa. So this will be the first chamber music performance by Mr. Whitaker since he has been hired as the concertmaster of the orchestra. So we're very excited about that.
No pressure.
He's very excited about the idea of playing the work as well. So we're looking forward to a wonderful performance of Julian's really wonderful string quartet.
Well, tell us about the next work then that will be on your program, Jerry.
The concertino for piano and tape by Elaine Erickson, who is a Des Moines composer. Elaine has been a member of the Forum for many years and always comes up with something unique and very interesting. This particular piece, well, it may be slightly misnamed because we're not really going to be using a tape. It's pre-recorded sounds, many of them computer-generated, to go along with the piano. So it's a very interesting and evocative kind of work. And this is going to be performed by one of the other composers, actually, in the Forum, Brooke Joyce, who's the composer in residence at Luther College.
And then you're going to have one of the founding members.
Yes, Linda Robbins Coleman from the Des Moines area is one of the original seven composers who founded the Iowa Composers Forum back in 1987. This particular work has quite an extensive background of success because it was the national award winner for the SAI fraternity, music fraternity, which is largely a women's organization, but they have a national contest each year, and this particular work was the winner 2 years ago, I believe. Images dangereuses, is dangerous images. It sounds better in French, I think. But in any case, it is a piano quintet work. The same string quartet that will play Jillian's piece is going to come back on stage, be joined by pianist Marita Wolgast for the performance of the Images dangereuses. That's fun to say.
And Linda Robbins Coleman has also been a composer in residence and done several things like that.
That's
in the
correct.
State as well.
That's right. She was another composer in residence with the Cedar Rapids Symphony Orchestra back in the 1990s. Exactly. And it's had quite an important impact among women composers, not only in the Midwest, but nationally.
And then you have another student who is going to be joining the mix.
Right. Jonathan Wilson is a grad student at the University of Iowa. He's from Illinois originally. And we have next three night pieces by Jonathan. One of the subtitles of the program, as a matter of fact, is Music of the Night. And part of that notion for that title came from Jonathan's pieces. These are Chopin-esque piano solo works, three of them quite evocative.
And then tell us about your elegy that comes next.
Raymond Sangelo is a composer who lives in Indianola and is a pianist himself, and he has created a work here for piano with three cellos, which is an unusual chamber music combination, but one that has a lot of color potential. And this is a lovely, a little bit mysterious kind of work called Elegy. Ray will play piano, and the cellists are all very well known in this area, two from Orchestra Iowa and one from Luther College. Eric Kutz is will be the principal cellist in this group. So we're looking forward to this. Ray's music always has a sort of Eastern European flavor to it, so that kind of adds to the mystery of his style.
Following that, you have the cello returning to the stage with a nocturne. Tell us about
this. Right, we're going to keep Eric Kutz busy on this particular program. He and his wife, Miko Komanami, will come back after the Sangelo piece to play Warren Gooch's Nocturne in 4-3. This is a very interesting, virtuosic work for the cello-piano duo. And Eric and Miko perform as a professional duo called the Murasaki Duo, and recently have toured and will be appearing later in the program as well. So this piece will be the first introduction to that particular combination of instruments on the program.
And an exciting work as well.
It is. Warren's been a member of the Forum for many years and is also a member of the board of directors of the Iowa Composers Forum.
Tell us about this next work that's on the program.
Robert Martin is the next composer representative. He is also on a faculty of Truman State in Missouri. And this particular work is a set of five piano pieces, which comes from a set of 100 piano pieces, 100 views of Mount Fuji, Each of them are small, sort of little scene painting pieces, not unlike haiku poems, each with its own particular mood. This group is called Stillness, and there are five works in here. Stillness, Field of Stone, Deep Canyon, Grief, and then finally The Sacred Mountain. So we're looking forward to this piano solo, Suite by Robert Martin.
Tell us about the next work, and this has a vocalist involved.
It does. This is a work by Brooke Joyce, who is, as I mentioned, the composer in residence at Luther College. This particular work is a presentation with baritone singer or baritone voice, violist, and the composer himself will play some small percussion instruments along with the melodica. Three poems is written by balladeers of Iowa history, really, and they're fascinating in terms of the historical content, the perspective one gets from the early days in Iowa. So we're really looking forward to this sort of folk-like quality that's going to be presented in this piece.
The whole concert is polished off, Jerry, by one of your pieces. Tell us about that.
It was my idea to put the piece on last. In fact, there was a small committee who decided what work should be put on, and it was the committee's decision. So I have to say that that's the case right out front. It's a work called Mr. Raggedy's Sublime Dance. And this is going to be performed by the Murasaki duo, again, cello and piano, Eric and Miko. When they asked me to write this piece, which was a piece that they have just toured with a number of other pieces that they had commissioned, they wanted something jazzy to fill out the program so it had a nice balance to it. So what occurred to me was that ragtime rhythms formed the basis of all jazz music, and I wanted to celebrate that fact. And so Mr. Raggedy, it's spelled with a T, it is a reference to the ragtime rhythms. And so the contribution that ragtime rhythms have made to jazz has been kind of this sublime dance over the last century, and therefore the title, Mr. Raggedy Sublime Dance. The whole work is a ragtime fantasy for cello and piano.
Iowa Composer Forum members, Co-College's Professor Emeritus, and Iowa Composers Forum Board of Directors Chair, Jerry Owen, and UNI Composition and Theory Senior, Jillian Whitaker. The Iowa Composers Forum Fall Opus Concert Cafe event starts at 7:30 this evening at the Opus Concert Cafe in Cedar Rapids under the auspices of Orchestra Iowa. The Opus Concert Cafe is adjacent to the Paramount Theater. Tickets will be available at the door for this Cabaret Atmosphere ICF performance. For more details about this concert, please visit iowacomposers.org. Also this evening at 7:30, Douglas Neat will perform at the Capitol Hill Lutheran Church in Des Moines. The concert is being sponsored by the Heart of Iowa Classical Guitar Society. Don't go away. We'll learn details about the Iowa Independent Film Festival's upcoming events and special guests. And we'll go backstage at Opera at Simpson to get an insider's view of their ambitious double opera offerings. That's all ahead. You're listening to the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
Filming a movie is a fun, wild, exhausting experience, and I couldn't be happier to be going back to Iowa to film. When I was in Girl Scouts troop in fourth grade, I remember going and seeing my best friend performing in Oliver, and I remember sitting on the stairs, and I was there with my whole Girl Scout troop, and then the lights came on, and my friend came on, and he was playing Oliver, Tate Moline. He's an alumni from Stebbins as well, and David Garver, who I've actually now done two movies and three shows on stage with. He was also in the show playing the Artful Dodger, and I remember especially with his character, the Artful Dodger, I just knew right at that minute that the lights came on, that this was what I was meant to do for the rest of my life. And so it was just seemed a natural progression to just dive right in, as I was taught in my community, you know, go big or go home, just dive right into Los Angeles, sort of the hub of film. And I've never had a question of whether or not this was the path that I was going to take as far as acting, producing, and writing. And it's been a great journey ever since.
Iowa's own Tana Frederick, co-founder of the Iowa Independent Film Festival and an independent film actress and star. Tana was born and raised in Mason City. She started her theater career on stage and working behind the scenes at Stebbins Children's Theater and in the community theater. She was valedictorian of her political science and theater arts University of Iowa graduating class, and it was the unparalleled experiences and challenges she faced at Iowa that helped her build her career in L.A.
There's some amazing playwrights that have come out of there. Tennessee Williams, there's some great artists that have come out of there. I was proud to finally get my face on the wall. There's this kind of wall of alumni, and if you have accomplished something or other, you get your face up there. So my honors thesis project in theater was actually to write and produce a one-woman show and act in a one-woman show. And so I was heavily involved with writing my own work, and I was always involved with other playwrights at the University of Iowa and putting up their work, the writer's workshop. And that really taught me to be very accepting of new material. Having grown up in Los Angeles now for the second part of my adulthood, things are always changing. There's always new ideas coming your way. And that really informed my work out here because I kind of became a yes woman. And out here, you know, you get scripts which are crazy and may seem strange, or the ideas are out there and they turn out to be huge hits. Some don't work, some work. And also the day of filming, you might be given three new pages. And so that was all kind of in my back pocket because of the Iowa Writers Program. I was ready for people to be changing their work at the last minute and to just roll with it. So it really provided a huge base for me to work from out here.
You talk about writing, and you wrote this three-page letter, which really changed the course of your whole life. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, with my University of Iowa honors background, I was doing a play out in Los Angeles, which was actually written by one of the writers from the writers program at the University of Iowa called Toussaint for the Love of Freedom. And one of the cast members came in and said, "Oh my gosh, I just had the best day working with this director named Henry Jaglom. He's the most prolific, amazing director that exists out there." And at that point, you know, I was waiting tables at three different restaurants and just trying to get my little toe in the door no matter how I could. And I said, "Well, how do I work with this guy?" And he said, "Well, if you write him a letter and tell him how much you love his work, he'll bring you in and have an interview with you and possibly cast you in the next film." So that night I went home and I wrote a three-page single-space letter about how brilliant I thought his film Deja Vu was, which is quite a brilliant film. And he called me in the very next day, wanted me to come see a screening of Festival in Cannes. I met him. We became friends. And then eventually I took a play of his, A Safe Place, and found a producer for it. And then after him seeing me in 8 different months of A Safe Place and holding my ground and being the lead in that, he cast me in Hollywood Dreams, my first film with him. And so that began our glorious friendship as an actor, writer, directing team. And it was 3 movies later, said, "You know, when I wrote that letter to you, I actually only saw the opening credits of Deja Vu and wrote you that entire letter based on watching the opening credits and never saw the film." And by then, of course, I had seen his entire library, every movie, probably plus 5 times. And he thought it was great. He laughed and he thought it was a great Hollywood hustle and said, "You know, that's what actors have to do in this town to really get their foot in the door. And I think it's brilliant and I love it." So it's my little white lie. It had a lot of heart and integrity behind it.
Well, at least you came clean. That was good.
Yeah, Henry Jaglom had workshopped a play when he was in New York in the Actors Studio that he had written. He had workshopped it with Harold Klerman and also Lee Strasberg, and starred Karen Black and Jack Nicholson and himself in it. And it's a great play. And then he had gotten his first $1 million in, I believe it was 1970, for this play to be turned into a movie. And so he starred Tuesday Weld in it. But the play was beautiful to me, and it had never been done as a play out here or anywhere else. And so Henry gave it to me. He hadn't even seen any of my work yet, and said, why don't you see what you can do with this? I'll give you this, and no royalties attached. Just go see if you can do a scene from acting class for it. You know, it's a good piece. And of course, I thought, well, can I get this produced? I asked Henry, and he said, yeah, you know, if you can find a theater, go ahead. So I shopped it around because I knew I was sitting on a little piece of gold, and because no Henry Jaglom play has ever been produced. And so I took it around to 8 theaters, finally found a theater, the Skylight Theater out here in Los Feliz, and ended up running the show. And that was how that segued into our working together on films. And it's just been a great working relationship ever since then. But that's how he first started to see my work and appreciate my work. And then the funny thing is, I showed him actually my Mason City High School performance of Guys and Dolls, and that sold him. I had done that at the Mason City High School summer musical program with Joel Everest. So I showed that to him, and he was in awe and said, wow, okay, you've got what it takes. I'm going to use you as my lead, and he proceeded to do so for the next 7 films.
And you and he then came up with this brainchild of starting the Iowa Independent Film Festival.
Yes, it was really fun for me to take our first film, Hollywood Dreams, to the Ashland Film Festival. It reminded me a lot of my hometown of Mason City and of the art fairs that we have there and the McNider Art Museum Summer Festival, and there were just a lot of parallels. And so I thought, why don't Henry and I begin a film festival in Iowa? And we called Dick Shino, who still is running the festival, and he hopped on the idea. And we started our festival off with a bang. And since then, we've had 7 years going strong, and we've had guests like Karen Black, David Provol, Andre Gregory, Randall Kleiser, who directed Grease and Flight of the Navigator, Mark Rydell, who directed On Golden Pond and For the Boys, and a lot of hugely accomplished film directors and actors come to the festival and have just been charmed by Iowa.
It opens on Friday night, October 25th, and the project that's opening it is called Garner, Iowa, and this is sort of part of your Project Cornlight. Tell us about your project and about this film.
Back when we started the film festival, the technological equipment wasn't available as it is now. The whole indie film world, it's changed. It's like the wild, wild west. I mean, people have access to inexpensive equipment. They can make films that can compete with big budget films if they have the heart and the wherewithal to go after that. And I really believe that there's still this idea that if you're on either the West Coast or the East Coast, you are allowed to be a filmmaker. But I wanted to encourage the community and be able to provide its own films that are completely filmed in state. And so what I came up with was Project Cornlight, which I said I would bring a couple actors or directors from LA out, but everything else would be filmed in-house. And when I say in-house, I mean in the state of Iowa. So we brought out Tom Bauer, who was in Die Hard, and he's been in a ton of films, of Walton's, TV and films. And I brought out director Ron Vignoni, who's had extensive work with Sony and other films. And then other than that, I used all local actors and all local businesses, all local sets. I mean, it was a rich, rich place to film our first movie, Garner, Iowa. It was originally called The Farm, but we switched the name to Garner, Iowa, because we filmed in Garner and because I felt it was appropriate for us, this is our first Project Cornlight film, to call the movie Garner, Iowa, named after a town in Iowa that we shot in. And it's a beautiful story of something that I've gone through with my own grandfather, and there's different subjects that are very delicate, but it's presented beautifully. Basically, I play a girl who has been in jail after being bipolar afflicted, and she comes back out of jail, and she is kind of lost and doesn't know where to go, and she decides that her sort of calling at the moment is to let her grandfather die on his farm that he loved in Garner, Iowa. And so in this, my character is able to take control of that situation and against her family's wishes, Tom Bauer, who plays my grandfather, and take him out of the nursing home. And in doing so, reconnects with her family. And it's just a, can't tell too much or I'll give away the whole movie. But we are very excited to show the rough cut screening and kick off the festival with a rough cut screening.
You've also planned to include a Karen Black tribute.
Yes, Karen Black came to the festival the very first year. She was such a wonderful, glorious addition, wonderful woman. And so I organized a memorial for her out here at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery, but it seemed only appropriate, and I've been working with her husband on this, that we're going to give her a tribute at the festival because she's really won a special place in Iowan's hearts. And so we have her recent movie, which people haven't seen yet, Vacation Land, and that's going to be shown. And we're also doing a 10-minute tribute of all of her films. And she has an award at our festival, the Karen Black Award, which she's always chosen who is going to get that. So it'll be a special person who gets that this year.
You have a film that's about the Mason City Choir, a 90-minute documentary. Tell us about that.
Oh, this is one of my favorite films. It's called Invisible Threads, and it's by filmmaker Gary Ewing. Gary took a year and filmed the Mason City Choir. He brought alums like myself in there for interviews. He brought other alums like Allison Ewing, who is on Broadway and has done lots of work on Broadway. Tate Moline, who is another successful graduate of Mason City High School and the choir program. And it just tracks Joel Everest and his whole journey there. And the film has actually been picked up by Iowa Public Television, which is a really big deal. So we're going to be showing that at the festival. And it's just one of my favorite films that's come out of the festival.
There's also a 91-year young filmmaker who has submitted a work who grew up in Mason City.
Yes, and we're very excited about that. Ralph Sineski, he grew up in Mason City, and then he went off to Hollywood to direct tons of TV shows, including Star Trek and Gunsmoke. He directed a short feature, and he's going to be attending the festival, and we're really excited to have him as well.
Tana Frederick, co-founder of the Iowa Independent Film Festival and an independent film actress and star. To get more details about this year's Iowa Independent Film Festival being held on October 25th through the 27th at Mason City's famous Frank Lloyd Wright Historic Park Inn, please go to their website at iowaindy.org. Just ahead, the music and stage directors of Operette Simpson will fill us in on their powerful paired opera offerings. You're listening to the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
Britten said that he wanted to create, I quote, a totally new operatic experience. And taking basically a neo-medieval mystery play and suitable for Christian audiences, taking that Japanese subject matter and turning it into a Christian parable. And as far as wanting to create a totally new operatic experience, I think that's exactly what he did. There is nothing like it. And even although Britten did use some similar procedures in later works, this piece is truly unique and well worth the hearing for it.
Bernard McDonald, music director and assistant professor of music at Simpson College. You're listening to the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Bernard McDonald, serving as music director, joins forces with stage director and Simpson's associate professor of vocal music, Bruce Brown, to produce Operette Simpson's dual fall opera offerings. Puccini's Suor Angelica was the centerpiece of a triptych written for the Met in 1918. Over the past 50 years at Simpson, it has been presented 6 or 7 times. Both Bruce and Bernard think that Britten's Curlew River may be an Iowa premiere. Bernard and Bruce share a bit of background behind their selection of these two unusual operas.
The backstory to this is, as ever, we were looking for pieces that were good showcases for our students, and we were looking at the broad range of students and how we could serve that population. And we reckoned that Suor Angelica was a very good vehicle for the population of women that we had. But we equally wanted to showcase our very talented young men. And as we explored it, it seemed that if we did a one-act opera that was all for women, we needed a one-act opera that was all for men. And I had a brainwave at one moment when I realised that Britain's Curlew River, of course, was all for men, and that they had some commonalities, such as an ecclesiastical setting of sorts. You know, one is set in a convent, and the other was designed for a church performance, and the men play the part of monks who relate a parable. So there was that commonality. There's also the fact that Sister Angelica is in the convent because she got pregnant out of wedlock, and ultimately she discovers, of course, that her child has died, and she kills herself essentially to be with him. And there's also a child involved in Curlew River, and the mad woman in Curlew River, who is played by a tenor, is rendered mad by the fact that she's lost her child, who we learn has been kidnapped and is enslaved. But we learn that the child died of natural causes. And when the mad woman is led to his grave to pray, she hears his voice, and as she does, she's cured of her madness. So we have these extraordinarily powerful, very moving works centred around a kind of redemption that comes through the death of children. A very, very powerful subject. And at the same time, these pieces are as drastically different as pieces of theatre as you could ever imagine. Puccini, in a sense, is traditional opera in that the narrative, the structure, the storytelling is something that with which audiences are very familiar. It's relatively naturalistic, and of course it relies on traditional musical structures. Curlew River, on the other hand, is a piece that comes really from a kind of experimental phase of Britain's career, written in the early 60s and premiered in 1964, in which he dispenses entirely with the conventions of Western opera and tries to invent a new style of musical storytelling. And so they are extremely different experiences in every way, and at the same time they are certainly unified by a sort of common theme, but other than that they are drastically different. One of the interesting things about Curlew River is that the subject matter came from Britain's visit to Japan. I think it was 1956 when he saw a piece of Japanese no theatre called Sumidagawa, which is Sumida River, and essentially it is the Curlew River story, as it later became. And what Britain did was take the Japanese theatre piece and adapt it for, and transplant it also from medieval Japan to medieval England in a monastic setting, and the kind of whatever spiritual aspects there are to the Japanese piece, be it Buddhist or whatever, they become a very strongly Christian message in Curlew River. But there are many aspects of Japanese music that are integrated into Curlew River. Even the sonorities played by the organ in Curlew River really come from sounds of Japanese music that Britain heard, such as the shō, which is a very exotic multi-reed instrument. So there are kind of tone clusters in the organ that are derived of Japanese music. You also have bell sounds that are certainly oriental. You know, Britain's interest in Asian music actually goes back to the 30s as well. So there are other aspects of Curlew River that are very non-traditional. It's notated differently. There are basically no time signatures in the score. And it really goes back to a kind of medieval concept of musical pulse related to the heartbeat. And it's conceived as a conductorless piece. And it's also composed for a usual ensemble of very virtuosic instrumental parts, for which we are delighted to have secured the services of some of the best players in the Des Moines area to play.
So how does one go about putting this show together and directing it and making it work with both of these two very opposing operas?
We were faced with some challenges, budgetary being number one in terms of Could we afford an elaborate set for both pieces, or could we come up with a design that would work for both pieces? And our set designer and lighting designer is Alan Edwards from New York City. We'll be coming out and actually be in residence between October 2nd and the opening of the show. So the set is timeless. It could be in medieval times, 15th, 16th, 17th century, a facade of a chapel. And how to make that set look different for both pieces is one of the unique challenges that will be done with lighting. Sister Angelica in the courtyard of the chapel will have a working fountain. There'll be a small garden plot. There'll be the table with the prayer candles on it, some hanging plants, because Angelica herself, her learned knowledge in the convent is how to work with herbs and flowers and make special medicines and cures for various ailments. Remove all those items except for the facade of the church for the Curlew River. And in the language of how we're going to tell the story for that particular piece, these monks, which was within the time period in England in the 15th century, maybe were seeking divine providence, and they could have been a group of wandering monks, which is the way new abbeys were built, actually, in England at the time. And they just happened to stop in this location to tell their parable. So whereas Sister Angelica is more of a modern-day parable, this is an older parable that comes from the Japanese Nō theater. And I think one of the challenges, too, is for the young casts that we have, they have no idea what life was like, or any of us have any idea what life was like to be a monk in the 15th century or a nun in Italy in the 17th century. So most of the nuns we've, in our research, have found at that time were not there by choice. It had to do with a family might have two or three daughters, and they could only afford to pay a dowry to one suitor to marry off one of their daughters, and the other daughters may have been sent to a convent, which also had to be paid a dowry, but not as high as a suitor. So Puccini captured a lot of this historical element in the music and the dramatic implications very well, where the first-year novices, that it's their first year they're in the convent, they're not really happy to be there. They haven't really adapted to life in the convent, so they throw temper tantrums, they don't follow the rules, the regiment like they should, whereas the older nuns have been there longer. So to bring those challenges out, to have the differences between the young novices and the more, I guess, mature nuns will be one of my challenges to show that off. And the Curlew River, the challenge is that Britten was so specific in the score, and Colin Graham was the original stage director, that he has a whole section at the end of the score detailing what exactly he wants for the movement and the style of the drama. And it also involved wearing masks, which Japanese Nō theater used. We've decided not to use the masks, and we will have a stylized movement, but it's not going to be copied exactly from the Colin Graham Britten original version. I've talked to some of the guys, and I think we might do a little experiment where they actually shave their heads into the monk fringe, because monks in that time period cut their hair that way for hygiene and also to be subservient to God. There's no facial hair. That was also part of their hygiene. So if we could actually talk the cast into doing this, because they have to act and form a unit on stage, it might help the challenge we face in making them brothers and making them monks.
There is an aesthetic to Curlew River that is very fraternal. It involves communal singing among the brothers. One of the things I've thought as we rehearsed this is, I think one of the things about Curlew River that for members of our audience who have never heard this piece before or experienced even something like it, it's a different world. It's a different kind of musical temporality. It feels like time stands still. The other thing is that rather than having a kind of homogeneous musical texture, Britten takes advantage of a kind of what we call heterophony, different music taking place simultaneously, but entirely different. I mean, not related to each other, to create a kind of sonic, I don't want to say it's a collage, it's not. It's really entirely separate musical entities that are then take place at once. So you have things like, you know, bitonality, tritonality, and you can take all these musical elements out and they're just kind of self-sufficient on their own. But when you perform them together, it creates just the most extraordinary sound world. Britten's strategy seems to be to create a different sense of timing. It's I think it's the most remarkable piece of musical theater.
Story is so easy to follow, as opposed to a lot of time opera is high and loud and fast, and you really don't know what the character just said, no matter what language. This one is very easy to follow. And as the monks within the play listen to the madwoman, who I think really one of my perceptions of why she's mad is it's guilt. It's mother's guilt that her child had been kidnapped. And this tremendous release of the guilt when the miracle at the end takes place where she sees the vision at the tomb of her son. So both pieces have this wonderful miracle at the end, which I don't think any stage director would bypass staging a miracle. And we get to do two of them this time.
Bernard McDonald, music director and assistant professor of music at Simpson College, along with stage director and Simpson's associate professor of vocal music, Bruce Brown, talking about opera at Simpson's upcoming productions of Puccini's War Angelica and Britten's Curlew River. The opera at Simpson performances will be presented on Friday and Saturday evenings, October 10th and 11th at 7:30, and again on Sunday afternoon, October 12th at 2, at Leckberg Hall on the Simpson College campus in Indianola. For more information about the performances and tickets, please see simpson.edu/music/opera. Today's Iowa Arts Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks for this broadcast goes to Jeff Fleming, Jillian Whitaker, Jerry Owen, Tana Frederick, Bernard McDonald, and Bruce Brown. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's production assistant, Tony Daner. Thanks for this show also goes to Iowa Public Radio's Al Scherz, Eric Jordan, Jason Burns, Garrett Van Leeuwen, and Cooper Holmeyer. Program research was provided by IPR's Nick Carlo and Tressa Glass. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Thanks for joining us. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.